This is part two of my chat with Mark Seaman. In part one, we talked about functional programming, side effects, purity, determinism, Dijkstra, abstractions, and monoids. We pick up the conversation with me asking Mark about unit testing. I want to ask a couple of other questions that are kind of on my mind. So I imagine as well that pure functions are easier to unit test because, well, I assume you don't need to mock anything.
Absolutely. Is that correct? Yeah. There's a good rule of thumb in growing object-oriented software guided by tests by Nat Price and Steve Freeman. And they say in object-oriented programming, you have a piece of terminology. There's a principle called the command query separation principle, which was actually introduced by Bertrand Meyer back in the 80s, I think. But basically what you're saying here is that you have some sort of operation that could be a method or procedure, whatever you want to call it in your language of choice. And it makes a distinction between two types of operations, one that changes the state of the system, funny enough, and then another one that just returns data. And we call the one that changes the state of the system, we call that a command. And the other operation that returns information about the system, we call that a query. So does that sound familiar already?
Mm-hmm.
I think it does. So it's not quite the same because Bertrand Meyer back in mid-80s didn't make so he made the distinction between side effects and no side effects. He didn't make the distinction between deterministic and non-deterministic. So we're not quite at the same place, but we're getting pretty close. And then what Steve Freeman and Nat Price says in Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Test is that they say you should use, whenever you have a query, you can replace that object with a stub. And whenever you have a command, you can replace that object with a mock. And I'm getting coffee here. Thank you. So basically, whenever you have some sort of, you know, interaction with the outside world, if you want to ask the outside world a question, that's a query, and you can replace that with a stub. If you want to do something to the outside world, that's a command, and you replace that with a mock. But then again, we're back in this thing with a pure function, is that it doesn't ask the outside world about anything, because that would be non-deterministic, and it doesn't do anything to the outside world because that would be a side effect. So you don't need mocks or stops with pure functions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then one other thing I wanted to kind of clear up as well is, because we have relied on dependency injection for so many things, do you still use dependency injection in impure functions to pipe in your DB context or, I don't know, your HTTP client or whatever it happens to be?
Do I still do that?
Would you still use a dependency injection type of approach to putting, let's say, I've had an example recently where on startup.cs in my C# program, I go into the configuration system, I come back with some endpoint, I create a HTTP client, I set its base address to that, and I pass it into a controller for further execution.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume you will still need to do things like that with F#, you know, call remote services. So would you use dependency injection to create that HTTP client and pass it to an impure function?
Well, so the HTTP client itself will be doing something impure because it will interact with the outside world. So if you pass that as an argument to some other function, then that function will be impure as well. So the exercise in doing, you know, if you really want to do functional programming, you can't do stuff like that because all your code will be impure. And in F#, it's still compile and it'll work, but it's just not going to be functional. So I think the first thing we need to do here is just to take a step back and say, does it matter? Because we've known for many years that, you know, while dependency injection in object-oriented programming is not perfect, it does enable some stuff that you can do some separation of concern, you can do some decoupling, and you can do testability and so on. It makes things, while still complicated, it makes things easier than without, you know, dependency injection. And we know it works, you know, because people have been doing that for many years in C# and Java. So can you do that in F# as well? you absolutely can. And there are many other things that just makes F# a more productive language than C#, in my opinion. If you basically decided to program in F# because of some of the other things that you care about, then you can still do all the impure stuff that you want and do all the dependency injection that you want in F# and still get the job done. And, you know, as long as you're productive, then, you know, why should I tell you that that's wrong? It's not wrong. You're just using F# to be productive, and that's fine. So my overall point with all of this, and the reason why I'm giving, you know, conference talks about this, and the reason why I'm, you know, I have an article series about this, is just because I'm very curious by nature myself. And I was just thinking about, you know, okay, so what does it actually mean to be functional? Is this really a functional thing? So if we should take this a little bit stepwise, then, you know, after I figured out how to do dependency injection many years ago and I wrote a book about it, I started to do F#, and then I also tried to answer the question myself, you know, how do I do dependency injection in F#? And after a couple of years, I arrived at this thing where you can do something called partial application. And basically what partial application means is that functions in F# are of a form that we call Currid, named after the mathematician Haskell Curry. So we'll get back to the name Haskell later on. Actually, it should have been called Schönfinkelstein something, because there was actually a German mathematician that came up with the concept first. But, you know, we don't say Schönfinkelstein. I can't even remember the name, but it's something like that. We don't say that because currying sounds cooler. So that's where, you know, an easy to pronounce name gets you. The idea about currying in F# is that if you imagine you have a function that takes three arguments, what you can do is that you can call that function with only the first argument. Something you can't do in C# or Java. You have to pass all the arguments, but in F# you can just say, well, I'm just going to pass the first argument. So that compiles, and not only does it compile, what it gives you back is another function that's just waiting for the arguments that you didn't pass. That starts to get very, very close to dependency injection, because basically then what you can do is you can take a function that takes three arguments, and then you can pass the, you know, if the first argument, for example, is a DB context, as you mentioned, you can say, well, you have a function that takes three arguments, whereas the first is the DB context, and the next two are, you know, the query parameters, and you want that to query some database somewhere. So if you pass the DB context to that function, now you have a function that waits for the two query parameters, but always sort of it already sort of closes around your DB context. So that's basically just like dependency injection. And if you write it just right, you can actually look at the IL code that it produces, and then you can decompile it into C#, and you will see that it actually turns out to be a class with the DB context as a private class field inside of it. But it's just, you know, a class that is being automatically generated by the F# compiler. So that is so closely related that it's basically the same thing. So this is called partial application, and it's basically the same thing as dependency injection.
Is that a recommended practice, would you say?
That really depends on whether you have this academic interest in writing proper functional code, or if you just want to get shit done. Because if you just want to get stuff done, then it's perfectly fine. And I've been doing that for many years, and it is the same as dependency injection in C#. So it has the same performance or impact, or not no particular impact, but it basically works the same way as you would do it in C#. So there's not a problem at all. It's fine. It's just not. It turns out, I'll get back to this in a little later on, that it may not be really functional, if you will. And you don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to matter to you, because if you actually have something that works and gets the job done, then, you know, why should you not be happy about that? So I would definitely say, you know, if you ask about whether this is a recommended practice or not, and say, well, it turns out to be pretty, you know, it looks pretty and it's very simple. It looks much simpler than dependency injection does in object-oriented code. if you care about functional programming, if you're chasing some of the other benefits of functional programming that are involved with having pure code and all of these things that I talked about before with the, you know, scary sounding Greek words and so on, then you may want to consider different approaches. But it really, you know, at this point, it sort of, you need to weigh your options and figure out, okay, what is it that's actually important to me? So I wouldn't say that there's a clear cut answer to that, but you know, in many cases, that would be a perfectly fine thing to do. So it's sort of a station on your journey towards being more and more functional, if you will. But you can definitely decide to just, you know, get off at that station and say that's fine.
To do this with the partial functions, as or sorry, partial applications, as you described, are there frameworks out there like we can get, you know, an AutoFac or a Castle or an Inject?
Right. Not to my knowledge, and I hope that there will never be such frameworks out there. So I'm not really, I'm not much a fan of dependency injection containers overall. And I know that in the book that I wrote back in 2011, there's about 200 pages that cover various different dependency injection frameworks. But my personal approach to DI containers is that there are some niche scenarios where they make sense, but in most cases, I think that basically what they do is that they take away a lot of the type safety from you, you know, because now you can have, you know, something where you just ask the DI container to resolve something and then you get a runtime exception because it wasn't configured correctly. Whereas if you take the DI container out of the picture and do what I call pure DI, just, you know, plain old, you know, just newing up objects in your composition route, then you actually have well, you have what feels like a little bit more of a maintenance burden, but basically what you just have is that you have compile time, you know, static type checking of whether you composed your object graphs in a proper way or not, instead of, you know, first discovering that when you're trying to run your application. So I'm not really much of a fan of DI containers overall, anyway. I haven't seen anyone who's tried to do that with F#, and I also think that, you know, I much more prefer to have the static type checking involved in this anyway. So I wouldn't really be interested in that either. But I'm sure it would be technically possible to do that if you wanted to. It's all reflection based anyway, or it would be, would have to be.
So we've been talking about DI and partial functions, and are they functional? Because, you know, I would have assumed that something being passed in, like a database, will have side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to call them functional?
Right. So I sort of couldn't really figure out the answer to that question for a long time. So what I ended up doing was that I said, well, you know, in order to actually try to understand, you know, what's the answer to this question, I tried to port some of my code to Haskell, because one of the interesting things about Haskell is that this rule about pure functions not being able to call impure functions, that rule is actually enforced by the type system in Haskell. So if you try to call an impure function from a pure function in Haskell, it's not going to compile, which is not the case in F#. So just to remind everyone who's listening here, you know, if you have a pure function in F# and you start calling an impure function, that function just conceptually also becomes impure, but you don't really notice that happen. So you sort of, that can actually happen accidentally. And it's actually, you know, that's actually happened to me quite often with F#, when, you know, if I'm not really paying attention to exactly what I'm doing, I may end up having something that actually turns out to be impure, even though I thought it was pure. And sometimes, again, you can say, well, okay, it doesn't matter. But sometimes I think it's just interesting to know what you're doing. So I tried to port some of my implementations that uses partial application for dependency injection, and I tried to port that to Haskell. And then, you know, to my surprise, I discovered that it actually doesn't compile in Haskell, so you can't do that. So I had to retrace my steps and try to figure out, okay, so why is that? Why doesn't it work in Haskell? And it turns out that is, you know, you have this universal rule that you cannot call an impure function from a pure function. And basically, whenever you do dependency injection, all the stuff that you tend to inject is something that is impure because it's either, you know, non-deterministic, you're querying a database, stuff like that, or it has some sort of side effect, you know, you're sending off an email, putting pixels on the screen, whatever it is. So dependency injection tends to make everything impure because the only way you can call an impure dependency is if you're yourself impure, and so on all the way. But that's not possible in Haskell because it doesn't compile. So the next thing I had to figure out then is, okay, so how do you solve the problem then? Because you still need to query databases and you still need to be able to send emails and put pixels on the screen and so on. You still need to be able to do that, but somehow you need to figure out a different way to do that. And fortunately, it turns out that the entry point of a Haskell program is always impure because it's non-deterministic. Just the fact that, you know, a program runs is basically already non-deterministic at that point, because it may happen at different times and in a different context and so on. And the fact that it produces some sort of result is also impure because you need either to send that result back over the network or put it on a screen or something like that. So Haskell programs are at the boundary. They're always impure. And because they're always impure at the boundary, that means you can do anything you want because there are no rules for impure functions. So the entry point is impure. So what you can do, shortly told, is that you can say, well, since I'm already in the impure entry point in the Haskell program, you can query the database and you can do all sorts of collect data from all sorts of impure sources, like, you know, asking your system what the time is and what the date is and whatever you want to do. And once you've collected all of that information, you have data, and then you can use that data as input arguments to call a pure function or a set of pure functions, because you're still in an impure context, and that means you can do anything you want. But as soon as you call that pure function, the only thing that pure function can do then is to call lots of other pure functions. But sooner or later, that, you know, top level pure function, if you will, that's going to return. It's going to give you an answer back. And now you're still back in the entry point of your Haskell application, that now you've received, you know, a pure answer from a pure function. And now you can do some more impure stuff with that, with the answer. So now you can take the result of that pure function and send it as an email or print it on the screen or whatever it is that you want to do. So I call that an impure, pure, impure sandwich, because it sort of looks a little bit like a layer there. It has the good stuff in the middle, but you sort of need the impure stuff around it in order to even be able to handle it. So I don't know. Do you know, by the way, do you know the story about why a sandwich is called a sandwich?
No.
No. Well, so
I thought it was a Lord Sandwich who had a piece of bread. Okay, yeah, but you know it better, so please.
Right, yeah. So it was the Earl of Sandwich, which is a place. It was a place in England, and one of the Earls, there's probably been more than one Earl of Sandwich, but one of the Earls of Sandwich was a notorious gambler, and he was one of those gamblers who was so much into gambling, he was playing cards, that he didn't want to stop to eat. So sometimes when they were playing cards, he would ask his servants to bring him something that he could eat with one hand without, you know, getting grease on the cards, because, you know, then they would be marked and so on. Yeah. So they came up with this concept of just, you know, slicing a couple of pieces of bread and then put, you know, some good stuff in the middle. And the whole point of the bread is exactly to make sure that you can handle the greasy stuff without getting grease on your fingers. So I think it's actually a nice metaphor for what we're doing in Haskell, because you need the impure stuff. So the bread is the impure stuff, and then the pure stuff is actually the greasy stuff. So that's okay. So maybe the analogy doesn't hold completely, but anyway, the idea here is that I think I said earlier on that pure functions are so impractical that you can't even call them without having sort of, you know, tweezers or something like that that can actually manipulate them. So the impure stuff that you have, the impure code that you have, is what enables you to actually manipulate the pure code, if you will. So a lot of times you can set up your Haskell code so that you get some impure stuff ready from all sorts of different impure sources, and then you pass all of that off as data and just call a pure function for that. You get a result back and do some more impure stuff. So that's why I call it the impure, pure, impure sandwich, if that makes sense.
Is it always possible to do that, to always have this boundary which does the dirty work?
Right. Yeah. So that's actually a very interesting question, because it's not a generally applicable type of architecture, but it's surprisingly often possible to do this, because what I often tend to do is I write lots of web services, typically RESTful APIs, for example. And whenever you're in the situation where you have HTTP based services, web services and so on, what often happens is you have an incoming HTTP request and you need to deal with that HTTP request within a very short amount of time. Typically you want to be done with that within a second. So in that case, each individual request often tends to be self-contained, in the sense you have some incoming data, which is, you know, the incoming HTTP request, and then you may need to go and query some your environment and query your database based on that request. But then you can, you know, pass off all the data that you've collected to some sort of impure, to some pure function, and then it can give you a result, and then you can return from that. So whenever you have an application architecture that is basically based on lots of maybe parallelizable but very short-lived, you know, events that somehow happen, you can often do this. It's, you know, most web-based applications can work in this way. If you have message-based applications, like things where you put, you know, messages on a message queue, and you have command handlers that, you know, are pulling events off a queue, you know, each event you can handle in this way as well, and so on. So a lot of, you know, a surprising large amount of applications can actually be written in this style. But there are other types of application where this doesn't apply, and then you sort of need to look towards different alternatives. So one type of application where this wouldn't really work very well is if you have something that is very long running, and maybe you have a lot of user interaction. So so we're recording this using Skype, and we have a little chat window open here as well. So right now we're just chatting back and forth with each other in English. But if we just, for the sake of argument, that we imagine that you're writing your chat messages in English, and I want to see them in Danish, and we have some sort of very fantastic translation software running, and that translation software may actually be a pure function where, you know, you can just, you know, take an English sentence as a string and pass it as input argument to that translation function, and then it's going to return a string in Danish. And we could go the other way around as well. So the scenario that we're looking at here is that whenever you're typing something into that application, that is impure because that is non-deterministic. But then you want to take that impure input and pass it to the translation function, that is a pure function. And it's going to return a pure piece of data back, which is just the translated string. But now you want, or my application wants to display that in Danish on my side. And that again is a side effect, because it wants to print something on my screen. But then, you know, I want to answer your thing, and then the translation goes the other way around. So you have this constant, you know, interleaving of, you do something impure, we call a pure function, then we do something impure again, and then, you know, you do some more impure, then we call a pure function, then we do something impure again. So in this case, it might be difficult to actually do this, you know, strict impure, pure, impure sandwich, because we're sort of always, we're running a long-running process that sort of needs to do this all the time. And again, you know, how you solve this particular problem in pure functional programming language is really depending on now what sort of language are you actually talking about, and also various other different options that language gives you. One thing you can do in order to solve a problem like that, which you can do in both Haskell and also you can port it back to F#, is something called a free monad. And I'm not going to try to explain that here, because that's, you know, exactly, you know, the details of how that actually works is not podcast friendly. It's not as difficult that some people may want to, you know, make you think that it is, but it's you need to look at a little bit of code in order to understand how that works. But this is one model that enables you to model ongoing processes in a pure fashion. But there are advantages and disadvantages of that particular approach. And one of the problems in Haskell, for example, is that it tends to not perform optimally. So if you have something like we're just going back and forth with, you know, with the translation example that I gave you, what's going to be the overall determinant of how fast things are going is probably how fast we can type anyway. So in that case, you know, a free monad would probably be perfectly fine because that's actually not going to be the limiting factor. But if you want to do something where you just do a lot of, a lot of things going back and forth because there's two machines talking to each other, that might actually not perform as well as you'd like it to. And then Haskell gives you other options. Some of it is something called the MTL style programming, and let's not go there. Because again, you know, it's something that we can't really explain over a podcast. But there are various options to deal with that, which is still can be considered, you know, pure functional programming. But going back to a language like F#, this is probably then where I'd say, well, we could do it with free monads, but I'd probably just be pragmatic at that point and say, well, let's just use, you know, an interface like in object-oriented programming and just do dependency injection or partial application and then say, well, it's not strictly functional, but it's close enough to still make sure that the code is maintainable. And, you know, in the end, it's basically all it boils down to is whether you have code that is maintainable and does what it is that it's supposed to do. So, you know, there's lots of different, you know, things that you have to take into account there, and the language being one of them, and, you know, the performance you want and the readability of your code and all of that things, all of those things. But I hope that sort of gives you an overview of, you know, how to answer that question. It's not, you know, I'm not going into detail here deliberately because that's probably not going to be friendly for audio only.
You have recently published, I think, is it 3 blog posts on monads, and I see October 5th, 6th, right, and 10th.
I think so I wrote a little blog post article series called From Dependency Injection to Dependency Rejection, which covers, I believe, 3 or 4 articles, plus, you know, an overview article. And then that's sort of a link towards another article series that goes into free monads if you want to deal with this more long-running sort of architecture style where you have those long-running impure interactions, if you will. So that's another article series, and that's like 5 or 6 different articles there. So, yeah, you can definitely go to my blog and read to your heart's content there if that's what you want to do.
I'll put links to your blog, but it is blog.ploeh.dk.
Yeah.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the day, Mark?
Right. Yeah. So as you can probably sense here, I can basically just keep on talking about this for as long as you'd let me. We already talked about, you know, if readers are more interested or if listeners are more interested, they can go and read on my blog here. I think one of the things that I also want to point out is that we just briefly touched on the videos that I'm doing for Clean Coders these days. And what I'm doing here is sort of related, but has a little bit of a different perspective. So I'm doing a video series called Humane Code at the moment. And the main focus point of that video series is to talk about, okay, so how do we deal with the fact that we often write a lot of code that we have trouble understanding later on? And I believe that one of the answers, not the only one, but one of the answers to that question is to say, well, let's look at some of the universal abstractions that we somehow can know that have emerged, you know, so we can learn a lot from, for example, a language like Haskell, because it uses a lot of those very mathematical abstractions with the scary sounding names. But if we can somehow look past the scary sounding names and just look at, okay, what does it actually mean that a thing is a monoid, not a monad, but a monoid, for example, what does that actually mean? It turns out that it actually has lots of applications in object-oriented programming as well. But instead of coming up with our own abstractions, what people often do is that they sort of try to invent abstractions themselves. And that rarely goes very well. My thesis here is that if you somehow look to the abstractions that already exist because they're based in mathematics, which are basically, you know, universal laws, if you can learn from those and then you can start to apply those in an object-oriented programming as well, you might actually make your code easier to understand. So that's what that, you know, video series is about. And I'm also writing a blog post series about that as well. So I'm not really trying to get people to part with their money there. But if you want to, you can do that as well. But otherwise, you can just read my blog. It's free.
That's cleancodersplural.com, I think.
Yes.
Because there is a cleancoder.com as well, which doesn't bring you to the videos.
Yeah, with an S, yes.
Any conferences coming up, Mark, where people might see you give a talk?
Right, yeah. So I'm talking about dependency rejection here at a couple of places later in 2017. I'll be a lot in Eastern Europe, actually, because I'll be in Moscow, in Kiev, in Vilnius, in... Yeah, and then I'm gonna do a workshop in Helsinki as well. But that's about it. That's related as well, and a couple of other things. So somehow it panned out that I'm gonna be a lot in Eastern Europe this fall. I'm looking very much forward to that. But that's my plan so far.
On your website, can we find a list of upcoming conferences, talks?
No, actually you can't, but I'm have to work on that, because I used to have a link to this thing called lanyard.com, but it seems like that's sort of stopped, you know, it's in read-only mode, and it's been in read-only mode for at least a couple of months now. So I think it's probably stopped being a business now. So I need to scrape that until, you know, before it disappears all of a sudden, you know, completely, and then, you know, port that, the data at least, to my own blog. So it's part of my plan to put it on my blog as well. But right now I'm sort of in between a time where I can't really do that. So, but hopefully, you know, if it takes a couple of weeks before you get this episode edited and out, then it might actually be there.
I will put a link to your blog, I'll put a link to your videos on Clean Coders, and if you have the post, I'll put a link to your upcoming conferences.
Sounds good.
Mark Seaman, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Unreeled by Unheard Music Concepts from the album Industry.